bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by Wired Tree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello and welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Justin Robert Young.
Hello.
Mr. Brian Brushwood.
Yo.
And Mr. Bryce Castillo.
Hey, everybody. Back and better than ever.
So, gentlemen, I want to talk to you about a very interesting product reveal, technology reveal that happened last week. And our new overlords, the NeuroPigs.
Sorry? I thought this was going to be like the 120 hertz display on an iPhone, but NeuroPigs sounds like an awesome band.
Could be, because, you know, cyborgs are among us. They're cyber pigs. As Elon Musk unveiled, talked about, they gave us an update on Neuralink. And in the announcement, he basically gave sort of a status update to say where Neuralink was. It wasn't really showing too much about the advancement, although they've improved the robot and some of the sensing in this thing that's able to connect to your head. Now they're implanting these things in pigs. So apparently the market for brain enhancement in pigs is pretty huge.
Yeah. Everybody short your stock in bacon, because we're about to find out just how intelligent pigs are.
Yeah. So they basically at this reveal, what he wanted to do, said the goal of this was for hiring, and they wanted to show people where Neuralink was, and they wanted to showcase basically off, you know, some of the tech, but then show the state of the art with what they've been doing. And what they now do is they have a coin size, like a half dollar sized implant that they pull out part of the skull. They have a robot that does this thing that totally doesn't look terrifying. They pull out part of the skull, put in the implant, and they put all these sort of little threads that connect to the upper part of your cortex.
Can we take just a moment to pause and really drink in the fact that everything was said unironically, just
matter of fact,
like five years ago,
this pig's skull.
Yeah. Like 5 years ago, that might've been a bit that we were doing, but instead we're reading from an AP article.
So yeah, there's a lot, there've been other advances that have come there. And so I think they're kind of doing their approach towards this. So I don't think they have a new overall approach, sort of different strategies. But, you know, the goal for this right now is to help people who have brain disorders. Like, you know, they're looking at, basically, they've got breakthrough funding. They've got breakthrough approval from the FDA to basically help tetraplegics, people which there's just no treatments for right now, to basically help them try to see if they can reconnect. One of the things they talk about doing is putting a Neuralink in your head. And then another one, let's say the base of your spine, if you suffered a spinal injury, and using it to connect and send signals. And in the demonstration, they showed the pigs wired up, and the data coming from the pigs is fascinating, right? They put a pig on a treadmill, which you've never seen a pig on a treadmill. You need to see a pig on a treadmill.
It's adorable.
And from, it is. And then from the signals from the brain, they're able to map that.
Legs. Look at those little legs going on the treadmill.
So you see that? You can see the little dots on the image. That is the brain. They're picking up from the brain the position of the limbs.
So
brain, oh, so that's brain, where that's where the brain is.
Yeah, the brain is thinking this one, this one, this one, this one, this one, this one, yep, this one, this one, and that's how walking is done.
This one went to market,
right?
So this is So this is all the muscles that need to get activated, all the movements. Like that is, wow, that's awesome.
Then in another demonstration, they actually showed what happens when you listen to the nerves in the snout. And as this pig starts, you know, snorting through and touching everything, and you hear this, if you can play the sound, let's see.
Snuffles around and touches something with a snout, that sends out neural spikes, which are detected.
Oh, here. My word.
And so on the screen, you can see each of the spikes from the 1024 electrodes.
Oh, my
electrodes.
Word. Smell is number one magic. Like the idea that something not there that you can detect is magic, but to be able to process and record it like a fingerprint is even
now we need to be very careful here, especially because we got Tali Zarrell in our chat here, and let's qualify here, okay?
Like mom will bust us on this.
and for neuroscientists, for people in neuroscientists, this is a very frustrating thing because they're watching a bunch of chimpanzees sharing at shiny things going, ooh, 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 and they're like, it doesn't, we're staring at a mirror going, look at this TV, it's amazing.
Yeah. It does make me very happy that we have one adult in the chat every single episode. It makes me very happy.
What they're doing is they have this implant, I think, has like 1,000. I think they said it had 1,000 or the cable, like 1,000 different threads to try to measure different groups of neurons as they fire. Now, to get real precise, you need a lot more ways of channels to be able to do that. And we're far away from here. Here, they're able to measure major muscle groups, large things firing. It is not a very discrete thing. It's not like, I don't even know if we were picking up smell from that. That could have just been nose twitches and stuff like this. So,
which would be a reflection of some kind of experience that the nose was happening. It's a second degree indicator, but sure. I mean, it's not nothing, is what I'm trying to say. Like we could be excited.
Absolutely, yeah. It is a step forward.
Well, and. You know, we saw a lot of this during the handheld boom of the aughts and the tens, that a lot of these things had been done before. It wasn't like a lot of what we saw in the iPhone and the iPad and you know, all the devices that Google came out with and Samsung were things that were necessarily made up from whole cloth. The worth was putting it in people's pockets and getting it down to a price and in a finished product that people really, really were excited about. And I think that's ultimately the idea that, you know, Tali Zarrell is somebody that has worked in, you know, neuroscience for many years, that things that she has seen in a lab are now things that are, you know, being at least discussed by that company as more consumer facing than a lab work is. Like, that's remarkable, specifically if it can come to market, like a pig, like a little piggy.
Yeah, and it's the kind of thing here is the idea of a concentration of effort of taking people who might have been in laboratories, putting in them same building with engineers building hardware and some computer scientists, which happens in some labs and some places too today, to be sure, but trying to 10x that, and then under the guidance of Elon Musk, who has been very successful at rockets and cars and stuff, and working with. Let's make this very clear. It's not like Elon has decided he's going to be chief neuroscientist here. You know, rockets is one thing because that's in his wheelhouse. So he's got neuroscientists and other people working there to do this. Elon's ability to sort of say, okay, this is how we'll with this, with the technology side, this is we'll organize the research. You tell us what direction we need to go in, and let's figure out how to make that happen.
So how long until we see a similar demonstration only in the reverse direction, where it's like you're thinking a thing and you're controlling a thing, because this seems to be monitoring demonstration and what we want to do is control giant robots.
Well, that's the goal of using that, let's say being able to map limb movement, whatever, to see if there's an intentionality there, is that's when they're going to move into their next step, basically. When they're going to be putting this into people, the goal is going to be eventually is to be able to control them. But they say that the devices, they can send and receive signals through the threads, right? So that's another thing too, is the ability, it could send information back in and give you some sort of feedback. I mean, that's sort of, to figure out how to do that in a precise way, I think is a way off sort of thing, because it is the friggin' brain and these things are, you know, delicate, but on a broader sense, maybe soon. Yeah, we've seen other implant technologies able to let people do sort of some sort of control by trying to like concentrate on something or whatever and measuring both. We've done that externally and now we've done it. There's like, you know, deep cranial, you know, sensing and stuff, which is very intrusive and stuff. So could happen.
Yeah. Tally in the chat room again says one of the most revolutionary things that Musk is doing with Neuralink is bringing all these experts from different fields and giving them a gigantic check. The fact that they can literally just focus on delivering and not have to worry about writing grants or funding in and of itself is a revolution in this field.
1,000%. 1,000%. When you get, when the fourth richest man in the world says, let's make this happen. Tell me what you need. Tell me who you need. Oh, we need more people. Great. Let's go do, we'll go make a live presentation show what we're doing so we can get all, you know, people, anybody who wants to sort of work with us can apply to us. So it's absolutely, because, and, you know, Tally brings up just a great point of like, so much of trying to be a researcher at institution university is grant writing, trying to justify what you're doing and doing that. Research publishing is part of it. We need to publish when you're working for an organization like that. But the grant writing is so time consuming.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, money does make the world go round, Andrew. And that's why I would like to have all of you go round to patreon.com/weirdthings.
So
that
smooth.
Keeps this,
so smooth.
Perfect. Keeps this podcast going. It's not smooth when you call it out.
It's more smooth.
It's smooth out this read when you make it
worthwhile.
Oh, we're
pitching for our Patreon right now?
Doggone right.
I didn't even notice that.
Here's the windup, and here's the pitch for you to go to patreon.com/weirdthings. Get your custom RSS feed. Make sure that this show continues to happen. patreon.com/weirdthings.
That was really... Hats off to you, sir. Hats off to you. The smooth salesman, Justin Robert Young.
That's me. That's the smooth salesman.
So there was an announcement last week in the world of VR, and that is that Facebook has doing its beta, its public beta now for Horizons. And Horizons, for those who don't know, is their VR open world. Horizon, which is basically a world you go into using your Oculus device, and you can go talk to people, you can play games, and on surface, it's a lot like Rec Room, if you've seen that, and some other, you know, kind of do what you sort of want, and you can build things. You can go in there, you can create things like Rec Room, and it's Facebook, and it's got a big, huge effort behind it, and this seems to be kind of the wave of the future of what they want to sort of build.
Man, I wish I didn't have this irrational distaste for Facebook, full stop, because there's probably something good here, but I'm not going to try it. I'm not going to load it. I'm not going to do it. I'm upset with...
Well, all right. Let's actually kind of unpack that, because I do think that if this were so cool that, like, your kids really wanted to do it, you'd try it. If it was so cool that me and Andrew and Bryce were really into it, you would try it. However, I do think that there is something to be said here. And one of the other big stories that came out of Oculus over the last week is the idea that going forward, they are going to require a Facebook account to log in. Right, Andrew?
So, yeah, that's the other thing. It's they're phasing that in. When Facebook first acquired Oculus, Palmer Luckey made a statement that was authorized by Facebook and said that you are never going to be required to use a Facebook login for your Oculus Rift. Facebook has now said, coming like 2022, you're going to now be required to use a Facebook login for your Oculus. So that is frustrating. I'm one of these people, like, I don't go on Facebook. It's not for me. And I'm hesitant. I use my Oculus Quest because I love the Quest. And when they come out with the next generation Quest, I will buy that. My reason is there ain't nothing else out there. There's no competition for it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, and that's the question is this moment in VR going to be hurt by Facebook kind of saying, hey, look, we bought this company for a reason. And if it's going to gain adoption and we do believe we have a best in class product here, then we're going to take the data. We are going to take the information that comes from it because that's what makes Facebook go. Or is it something that we worry about? And in the abstract, we can say, absolutely not. I'm put off by this. But ultimately, if the product is the product and the software is the software, then we're just going to go along with it because we use an account to log into a bunch of stuff now that we probably aren't in love with.
Man, I would love to believe that, like, no, I've got my principles and my privacy concerns and I'm just over here with my arms folded. But the fact is, like, they just need the right game and they'll seduce me right in.
Yeah, and that is, I think, it largely because there aren't alternatives for the portable. There just aren't right now, you know, and I think that's they're going to be in a different situation. They're right now, like all of my friends who have Quests, I would say that 60% of them use them on a regular basis. They're like Quest heads, like they just love it. And I have some of you, some very, it's one of these things, it's very much early adopter cycle where you get the ones that kind of like, I like, you know, one of my friends, Simon, was a guy that was waiting for years to jump into VR because he had his little checklist. It's got to be portable. You know, I don't have to connect to a computer. It's got to do this, this, this. And when the Quest came out, he got it. Simon is like just huge into it. Simon's one of the co-creators of the magic puzzle thing that I brought up before. And Simon gave me a call the other day and he said, hey, I'm working on a game in Rec Room. Do you want to come help me out? And I'm like, well, let me finish doing my work on artificial intelligence and let me go have my most futuristic day ever by helping my friend with his project in VR. And we go inside of Rec Room, which is a game that's on all, you know, basically on every device. It's a company that was started by some former Microsoft people. And that's very much most of what you saw with Horizon. Rec Room does that. And I go meet him in this space, and then we go into the zone where, like, he's this virtual him, where you see kind of, he looks like one of his characters with the hands and the torso and the head. And he's built this different kind of, you know, shooting game, a shooting fighting game, because he had some different ideas on combat and stuff. And so he's walking around showing me this thing and quickly becomes just not weird. You know, we're like, oh, I'm building this over here. And he shows me the interface to build stuff, which all of a sudden he gives me the maker pin. And all of a sudden these circuit boards appear in front of you and these if and junctions and stuff. And it was, you know, it's amazing to see how this thing works. And then we start talking and we both just sit down and our avatars are just sitting down in VR as we talk for a half an hour about like the project. And I'm like, this is weird. Just, I'm looking at his VR simple little head and we're just carrying on having this conversation in a completely VR space. And I'm like,
but it's weird, not just that you're looking at his head, but that you're picking up actual emotional cues from very tiny micromuscular movements. You know, it's like, it's real. I mean, they're the telepresence is a real experience.
Absolutely. And that was that. And then he said, hey, I got a gun, I'm having VR brain. Cause I think he'd been in VR like for the better part of the day. But like, that is the thing, is the weight of that thing on your head sets in for a while. The lenses, VR lenses, Oculus is working on a pretty cool advancement in lenses, which is going to basically be this adaptive sort of thing. So things will be, have different ranges of focus, which is going to be a very, it's one of these things you hear about it and you kind of go, I guess so. I mean, I'm okay with it now. I just want more resolution. But everybody who tries it goes, no, when you see this, it just, everything pops and becomes real. I don't worry about field of view anymore when I'm in VR. I don't even think about that.
Like that is just, it's all there for you. You don't feel restricted that there's something off the edge of your sight line that you can't see.
Yeah. I don't notice it anywhere nearly as much as I did before. Cause I think that like with the Quest, which is a similar to the other ones, has a pretty good one. And I think we could use, but I think as these things get bigger and more expansive, and we saw before how Oculus is working on next generation goggles that are much thinner and lighter. It's going to be, Brian said, the moment in which it's, let me just put these things on and walk everywhere I want. You know, that's the VR singularity point, so to speak.
Yeah. Oh, totally. Totally. Although I do think that, you know, especially considering we spend a lot more time appreciating our homes lately, like if we're looking for Christmas potential, like I think the Quest could be a massive, I mean, like we've always been saying, you know, VR adoption, but like I kind of think like there's a lot of things that are falling in place both from a hardware and societal perspective that could see a big adoption for this.
Little Timmy, would you like to go outside? Would I? Well, you can't, but put these on. It'll kind of feel like it.
And it'll kind of feel. Yeah.
Raising your children in VR.
You could do that remotely too.
So I found maybe the coolest Wikipedia page ever. And let me just open this in my browser here. You ready for this?
Ready.
List of people who disappeared mysteriously.
Full stop. That's a thing.
Well, they have pre-1970, then they have after 1970, and then after 1970, you can actually get breakdowns, you know, by like you get to the 1900s, they do like kind of like really crazy specific.
And I'll give you, wait a minute, hold on. This is like literally the unsolved mysteries pre-production list. It's just like, this is amazing.
Let me start with the first entry. Circa 700 BC, Romulus, the founder and first king of Rome. Age at least 60. Missing from Rome. One day, Romulus was reviewing his troops in the Campus Martius near where the Pantheon is now. There was a sudden storm with lightning and thunderclaps. A thick black cloud hid him from view, and no one ever saw him again. Some people standing nearby said that he had been swept away by the tempest. Livy and Plutarch say Romulus's generals may have used the opportunity to assassinate him.
You want to talk unsolved mysteries? This is the real work right here.
Exactly. Yeah. If you or someone you know have any information on Romulus's whereabouts, please call.
So it is a fascinating list. Some of these were like, you know, organized crime boss, you know, Punchy Luciano was leaving a New Jersey cafe after a dispute with so-and-so and was never seen again. Like, yeah, geez, you know, but other ones are just fascinating. You know, like emperors and some kings and some other people go missing, you know. Just fascinating. So anyhow, if you want to take a look through there, and I think we could probably, I don't know, I want to look up some of the more contemporary, but let's just pick one. I'm going to have you guys try to solve
it. Sure, yeah. We'll solve it. Right,
let's solve it.
Yeah, no, we're good at that.
All right.
Solve things all the time.
All right, I got, here's clue number one. This person has a nickname.
Okay.
Raymond Crane Neck Nugent. Missing from Miami-Dade County, Florida.
Florida man.
Ah, there we go.
Egan's Rats gang member, killer and bank robber, in quotes,
holy
vanished.
Wow, man, you're hitting us with a lot real fast. All right, so he's a gang member, a killer, and a bank robber, and from Florida. And his name is Crane Neck. Got it.
Yep, and listen to Wikipedia. Quote, vanished. Literally quotes there. Quote, vanished. Yeah. No trace of him was ever found.
I mean, what year? What year are we talking about?
1931. Where were you,
Brian? We actually, we were talking in the pre-show. I don't know if it was at the beginning of this podcast about some VR videos we shot, and one of those, I think we had a bit of a different experience because we were down in the Everglades on a fan boat, and the only thing I could think of that I was like, I wanted to, you know, this is a family run operation that was operating these fan boats, and all I wanted to do was just edge toward, so what's the craziest stuff you've ever seen out here in the Everglades, without making any kind of accusations.
Between the lines, what you wanted to do was find out, like, okay,
what
you've been
happened
here
to
for 20
neck?
Years. Yeah, how many bodies have vanished out here?
Spoiler alert, I'm just going to declare it. That's where Crane Neck ended up. Like, if the Everglades is an amazing natural resource, it also is a place where nobody could realistically find anything, specifically if you go deep into it, and everything just decomposes with everything else in the water. It is a insane place that not only has been where many vanishings in South Florida, I'm sure, have legitimately ended, but also, you know, you got to get out there on something. It's only so many fan boats. You know, maybe you'd let somebody know, hey, you know, don't worry. There's going to be a bag of money, and I hope you have a great night's sleep tonight. Make sure that the keys are in the boat.
That was kind of the vibe I got from our tour guide. Our tour guide had seen some stuff.
Yes.
Yeah.
You should check out my upcoming book, Black Coral, which deals with things going missing in the Everglades. Just, it's reading some of the more contemporary things, but a lot of it looks like just, you know, some of it like, you know, so-and-so was in a fight with her husband about paternity, and then she was unable to show up at the hearings. You're like, uh-huh. So I'm looking for the cool ones. A lot of them are just kind of crazy.
How many in Florida?
Yeah, I mean, well, you know what, Brian? Some. yeah, a lot of you. It's just spooky because you start reading through these sort of things, and it's like, you know, this woman, Tiffany Daniels, in Pensacola, Florida. That was just totally random. So Daniels, a theater technician at Pensacola State College, left work early on August 2013 after telling her supervisor she would be taking the rest of the week off as she had some things to take care of. She returned to her home briefly, but was not seen by her housemate, who was on the phone at the time. 8 days later, her car was found in a Pensacola Beach parking lot, with witnesses reporting they saw a man in red shorts get out of the car and open its tailgate on the day it was found. No other trace of her has been found, despite extensive searches. But based on a description of a woman seen in a New Orleans area restaurant who resembled her and had some similar behaviors, her family believes she was abducted and became a victim of human trafficking.
That's heavy, Doc.
Cheeriest episode of Weird Things yet. Am I right?
I mean, that's these kind of stories. And again, I'll refer to Unsolved Mysteries here just because they have their new season on Netflix. But it's amazing what happens when you have missing person cases, especially ones that are done under mysterious circumstances, where you've got a lot of people that they want to believe. They desperately want to believe. Like, the idea of that woman being in human trafficking is a better idea than she was killed or she, you know, died or committed suicide or something like that.
By a dinosaur monster.
By a weird, spooky gator who doggy paddles under the waves. Like, it's nuts. I mean, and all sympathy to the families that have to deal with this stuff.
Yeah, and sometimes too, there are circumstances that we don't know. And I can't say in a case like that, but in other cases, you might be like, there could be like, oh, there was a history of drug use and things like that that's not brought up, and the family might have a reason to think, well, we think maybe this, because that is a weird place to go to say human trafficking.
Yeah. So yeah, it's I mean, but again, when something is truly out of, you know, at least to the family or the investigators, out of character, you can't rule anything out.
Yeah, yeah. So it is worth reading, and it is, a lot of it looked like people who went, you know, mountain climbing or in places, remote places, and sort of just disappeared there. And, you know, it is, some of these places are hard to sort of get to in some cases. Like, here's Craig Arnold, and American poet, disappeared after a hike on the Japanese island Kuchinobarajima. He is presumed to have died on a fall from a high cliff, but his body has not been found. So, so they're just, it's a very, very freaky, weird, disturbing thing, but weird.
I didn't know that they were all compiled like that, though. What an amazing website Wikipedia is. What a just a brilliant cross-section of human knowledge. Because no one would think, like, you would think that those would be in another, you'd have to search for those things regionally. There wasn't just one central repository of everybody post-Romulus who has gone missing in the world.
There is also, like, some of the interesting stuff, too. Like, you get some of the 1970s one. So, like, here's, 1970. After running out of gas on the Hollywood freeway, Graham was last seen by California Highway Patrol officers on November 15th, 1970. The officer directed her to a callback and later saw her speaking with a man beside her car. The circumstance of her disappearance resulted in CHP policies being changed to ensure the safety of stranded female motorists. It's an 18-year-old woman. Up and gone. And, you know, one of the things that's not... I haven't seen the new Charles Manson TV series, but one of the things that kind of is... talked about Manson was, it wasn't just everybody at the Sharon Tate house. It wasn't just some people. There was probably maybe quite a few other murders and stuff. And Manson probably earlier in his life was involved in some stuff. Wikipedia's got a lot of weird stuff in there.
Indeed. Indeed. Indeed.
Let's do some picks.
I got a pick. Man, James Cameron's stuff holds up. Like, I think universally. We watched The Terminator, Terminator 2. We just watched Aliens. Avatar is Avatar, but for what it is, it's fine. I think next up I'll make my kids watch Titanic, but Aliens, oh, it really holds up. And only now that I'm, you know, creeping up on 50 years old, do I realize that it's the tale of two mothers. It's mom on mom battle energy, and it's great. It's way, way good. The tension is great. Everything holds up about it. Burke should never have gotten that sitcom. It's awesome.
Do you know the story on how Cameron was able to, how he got to direct Aliens?
No.
So he had been, you know, he worked for Roger Corman for several years, and then he was writing some screenplays, and he became known as a sort of hot screenwriter, you know, up and coming screenwriter in Hollywood. And Sylvester Stallone came to him and said, "Hey, I want you to write a sequel to Rambo." And then like Fox went to him and said, "Hey, we want you to write a sequel to Alien." And he's like, "I love Alien. I would love to direct the sequel to Alien. I'd like to write and direct this for you." And they're like, "Yeah, yeah, James, that's great. Is it your last credit, Piranha?" Piranha 2, mind you. And so Cameron's like, "Fine, I'll write this for you." Meanwhile, Cameron had his screenplay Terminator, which he got independent financing for, right? He got the financing he got for Terminator happened. Part of the reason that people decided to back him was they went to the set of like Piranha 2 and they watched James Cameron outside directing. And he's like, "Okay, you know, lights, camera, action, worms." And they watch as worms crawled out of the ground because James Cameron needed worms to crawl out of that ground for that scene. And what he did is he had electrified the ground so the worms would come out. And all the people, the funders, the people, the backers are looking like, "All we know is he said action, worms, and the worms came out of the ground. Like, this is our guy. He knows what he's doing."
That is amazing.
So
such a great story.
He makes Terminator that punches way above its weight. You look at the budget of that movie compared to other budgets and stuff, and what he pulled off, incredible. Terminator comes out, huge success, and Fox is like, "You know who'd be a good director for Aliens?" "You, Mr. Cameron." So that's how we got Eric to Aliens, because the success of Terminator, he was already writing a screenplay for it, but like, you're a screenwriter, what do you know? When he wrote the screenplays for Aliens and for Rambo 2, he had to basically split his time between, he had two typewriters set up. One was a screenplay for one was a screen for the other, and he would go back and forth between the two.
Holy cow.
That's awesome. I got a pick. Bill and Ted 3. Face the Music.
Oh, was it good?
I had such a great time with it. I have such a fondness for that franchise. The thing that I've always loved about it, and really I love, you know, Excellent Adventure punches above its weight as an idea of like two stoners have 12 hours to not flunk out of school. And it really did it because it had this great societal lens. There's these like side characters like the, you know, Missy, who they both had a crush on when she was a senior and they were freshmen, that now is married one of their dads, right? Like there's all this. The identity of like youth culture as not something that is totally wasted, but rather might have this spark is very, very pure. That then evolves in Bogus Journey to, as like the universe literally expands exponentially. And now we're not just talking about stoners trying to do their homework. We're talking about people in their mid-20s living with the idea that the world exists and heaven and hell and knowledge and stupidity. And the new movie delivers on everything that I've loved about it. The characters are always multidimensional. the moments. There are like laugh out loud moments to me, and it tries to tell, I think, a very challenging story that that the series befits for itself. Like it's about youth versus age, and where these two characters that I think are very unique as youthful, you know, paragons now, you know, where they do and don't connect with their own impending mortality plus their daughter. So is it a perfect movie? No, none of them are. But to me, I wish we could have gotten if Bill and Ted was made at a studio that was still running, or that was like picked up or consumed by another larger studio, I feel like we would have gotten 5 or 6 Bill and Ted movies by now. And that is a timeline that would be richer and more excellent than ours.
I got a pick. A weird one. This is a half-hearted pick because I only watched a little bit of it. And I don't know where it's going, and I also don't. I don't know the original material. Sorry, high school English teachers. Was on NBC's Peacock and ended up watching the first 2 episodes, which are available for free, of Brave New World. Interesting. Very. I think, stop me if this sounds old hat, but kind of a pointed message, it seems, in Brave New World. But I think as
if it helps the original source material, the book was not shy about having a message.
Yeah, and so I think it makes an interesting mystery if you don't know what's going on.
so for whatever reason, you had never read the original.
Yeah, just was not on whatever our reading lists had been. So I'm going into it blind. It seems all right. Like I think the 3 main actors are pretty good at showing off the world that they occupy and how they seem to be deviations from the norm, let's say, of the society. I think the idea of the Savage Lands is interesting, and the way it's represented is kind of neat. I think this might be something I would give the Peacock trial for, because it's all the rest of them after episode 2 are in premium, so it's not just the ad free. You can't just watch them with ads. You have to subscribe to Peacock. So I might check them out. I think it's all right. It doesn't feel like it feels heavy handed in a way that I understand that book to be heavy handed, I guess is what I'd say.
I'm so fascinated to hear how it lands with you. Like if you need the cash, like I want you to go through the whole experience.
Sure.
And let me know if it lands.
Yeah, maybe we'll figure that out. But
yeah,
I think it's interesting because it you know sets up this very interesting dynamic of society where everyone is everyone's property, and trying to own have a family or love is a form of ownership and selfishness
and theft, and
yeah where you know good Christian values of monogamy and love and family are savagery, and so but then the freedom fighters don't seem to be portrayed, let's say, in a very favorable light. So I don't know. I'm sure everyone at home is like laughing because I don't know what's going on in the story. But I think it's actually pretty well done. And for Peacock, which is, I'll just say, I don't like their TV app. I don't think it's very good. I think when you watch something and you want to scroll around, I think it sucks. I think they made it an all right show so far.
Normally you don't like cock, but
That's the Brave New World on Peacock. Andrew.
My pick is, we mentioned this, I think, last week, but High Score. I finished watching all episodes of that, and I enjoyed it, the Netflix documentary about video games. And there are a ton of video game histories out there. There are a ton of them, and I've seen some criticism like, they should have done this story. They should have done this. Well, that's why there are books like Console Wars. I think the video game, like my favorite book was the one that the big, huge video game history or whatever. I think I mentioned before, there's a lot of great stuff out. It's kind of like, this 6 episode thing about the movie industry didn't talk about my favorite movies or whatever. Like, well, it's because there are a lot. And video games blew up, and it's such a big topic to cover, and I'm sure we're going to get more seasons of it. So I enjoyed it. I liked the way that I liked it. If it was easier for me to get into it than actually The Toys That Made Us, because The Toys That Made Us had this sort of stylish sort of way they did stuff that was a little bit, took me a little bit to kind of get into. Here, I liked the way they sort of, it was sort of the moments and stuff were fit around to it. And also The Toys That Made Us is that, like, I remember watching any interviews and going, I think I know that restaurant. And I realized that the production office was here in Burbank. And I'm like, I'd passed it like every other day. Cause I'd be watching the interview there. I'd be staring out the window going, I think I know where that is. And then I'm on Google Earth and I'm like, oh yeah, that's just right over here.
I really have liked High Score from what I've seen. And it is much more of a love letter than Toys That Made Us, which is a little bit more, you know, they really pit they create conflicts of how these things came about, right? And Toys That Made Us is often talking about bankruptcies and creative fights and who was right and who was wrong and stuff like that, where this is about, obviously there are stakes, but you are telling a story about an exploding world. And whoever you talk to, you are telling a story that is worth telling, and they are kind of pioneers. I've thoroughly enjoyed it so far.
I love that. I think if you want something deeper, this has been a pick I've had before, which is, I think The Ultimate History of Video Games, I think, is really, really great, in Console Wars. Both those are great.
So, yeah, it's like
audiobook, right?
Yeah, they're all in audio.
Yeah.
Brian, I would never try to put a dead tree in front of you. I know better.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that we're at a point now where this is very much, High Score to me feels like a video essay. It's just, it is like, you know, it's not the exhaustive, complete history of video games. It is very much a love letter and an essay that is done extraordinarily well.
Yeah. And I'll throw in another pick, also by Blake J. Harris, who is the author of Console Wars. The History of the Future, about Oculus and Facebook. It is a extremely in-depth book. And I would argue that, like, to get a really deep history of Palmer Luckey, who is a young person now who has already made waves in VR. He's one of the reasons why VR kind of accelerated the way it did, because he looked around and said, oh, we can do these things now. And you understand a lot more about his passion for VR and stuff. And then the internal politics of how he got kicked out of Facebook. And it's one of these things where, his political leanings and whatever were part of that, but then the way Facebook handled it, et cetera, it's a very good overview of this, but you come away at the very, He's very sympathetic. He's just a guy that never, even when people are yelling at him because, you know, Facebook bought Oculus and he's getting death threats and stuff, he's like, well, I know what it's like to be a gamer and I know what it's like to be this. And like in the middle of this maelstrom, he is this very sympathetic person. And now he's created this new company, Anduril, which is doing military defense technology, which not without its controversy. And it's going to be interesting to see what happens with that. And so I think if you want to, regardless of what you feel about him, regardless of what you feel about Facebook or whatever, there are people who are shaping things in technology that you, I think, are worth paying attention to and seeing. So I think History of the Future, great overview of Oculus, everything that's happening now, you could be like, oh, it's all been foreseen. So I recommend that. Really do recommend that book.
Right on. So, nice.
Gentlemen, it's been weird.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.